What's better than being on an excellent, successful TV show?
We have unlimited juice. This party is going to be off the hook.
Being on two excellent, successful TV shows.
Did I hear the VP scream?
There was a rat on the garbage, so I shouted to scare it off.
It was a man's voice?
Yeah, because I'm a man.
Today in Studio 360, I'll talk with the actor Tony Hale, who stars in a couple of today's best comedies, Arrested Development and Veep. And we'll take a trip to the Guggenheim Museum, where a world-class artist has done something truly strange to this iconic piece of architecture.
It was kind of like inhaling and exhaling colors.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that, plus the winner of our Great American Battle of the High School Bands. That's all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
You're listening to Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
We used to have a rock band back in high school.
Earlier this summer, we asked you to share the best piece of music you made in high school as part of our Battle of the High School Bands contest. And some of the songs you sent us were so good, you sort of bummed out the rock stars who judged the contest.
I can't speak for Andrew, but it did make me feel a little bit bad about what I did in high school.
It ruined my entire perception of myself in high school hearing this song.
Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen announce and talk to the winner of our Battle of the High School Bands and perform their own cover of that great song.
God of Rock, thank you for this chance to kick ass.
That's later in this hour. But first, Stephen King once called Elmore Leonard the great American writer. The novelist died this week at 87, and one obituary wrote that Leonard had, quote, helped achieve for crime writing what Stephen King did for horror and Ray Bradbury for science fiction. He made it hip, and he made it respectable, unquote.
When I sit down, I felt like different. Chris slid open the facing of the seat cushion. He said, hmm. Booker said, what you mean, hmm? Don't give me no hmm, sh-. What is it? What's in there? Chris looked up at Booker and said, 10 sticks of dynamite. Somebody doesn't like you, Booker. 2 sticks would have been plenty.
Apart from the wise guy humor that infuses so much of his work, Leonard's great strength was dialogue. Salty and funny, but also harsh and real. So it was a thrill for me to talk about talking with Elmore Leonard. We spoke in 2005 when he'd just published The Hot Kid, his 40th novel about Oklahoma gangsters in the 1920s and 30s. That was sort of a golden age of crime. Pretty Boy Floyd, John Dillinger, and Bonnie and Clyde all died in a 5-month period in 1934. Elmore Leonard was a kid then, 8 years old, and I asked if he remembered the era.
I know I do, because that summer in May, Bonnie and Clyde were stopped and shot 160 times in northern Louisiana. And a few months later, there's a picture of me standing next to an Oakland pointing a gun at a camera with my one foot on the running board, which was an imitation of Bonnie Parker, because she had her foot on the front bumper of a car and a cigar in her mouth, holding a pistol, which was probably in every paper in the country in May of that year. And I know that's where I got it. You know, I was making that. I didn't make it up. I'm cashing in on it and have been for the last 50 years, writing about cops and robbers.
Let me explain something to you. Bobo is dead, which means that everything he had now belongs to Jimmy Capp, including you, which also means that when I speak for Jimmy. E.g., from now on, you start showing me the proper f-ing respect.
E.g. means for example. What I think you want to say is I.E.
Bullshit. It's short for ergo.
Ask your man.
To best of my knowledge, E.G. means for example.
E.G. I.E. F- you. The point is this, is that when I say jump, you say okay, okay?
Yeah, right. Okay.
All right.
That is from the terrific film adaptation of your novel Get Shorty, starring John Travolta. Now, dialogue for you is obviously central in your novels, and you've said that readers tend to go for the dialogue and skip over the other prose.
Yes, I think so. The dialogue is not the parts that your reader is going to skip. And yet literary writers tell practically everything.
So
because they like the sound of their own voice the way they're telling it. Well, I don't show my voice. You don't hear me in my books.
Although over the span of them, clearly one can tell an Elmore Leonard book.
Yes, because of my characters. They're probably all alike. And then they're telling the stories.
As you say, you show rather than explain. You have your wonderful crackling dialogue. That sounds like the movies. That sounds like screenplays. But you wrote some screenplays in the past, but really haven't done much of that in the last 3 years.
I quit in 1993 because I don't get any satisfaction out of it. I don't get any fun out of it. It's work, and it's work for money. Thank God they pay you a lot of money. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. Richard Price, you know that name? He lives here in New York.
The novelist and screenwriter.
Right. He's turned down offers to adapt my books. He says, there's nothing I can do to them.
What's your favorite adaptation of one of your novels?
Well, I think that the most the closest one is Jackie Brown.
Really, the Quentin Tarantino?
Yeah, and that surprises me because you'd think that he might wander off a bit.
They advertised this Tech 9 as the most popular gun in American crime. Can you believe that? It actually says that in the little booklet that comes with it. The most popular gun in American crime. Like they proud of that.
So was Out of Sight and Get Shorty.
Yeah, you had a good few years there of great movies made out
very
of your books.
Very good. Three, right in a row. And Get Shorty, it sounded like my work because Barry Sonnenfeld told the cast, stick to the script, no ad-libbing. And I told him before he went into production, I said, I hope you don't cut away to, when someone delivers a funny line, I hope you don't cut to another character to get a reaction because these guys are not being funny, you know? Let the audience, if the audience wants to laugh, fine.
Elmore Leonard, the master crime novelist who died this week. I spoke with him in 2005.
Double rainbow all the way across the sky.
What's your favorite internet rabbit hole? YouTube videos? BuzzFeed listicles? Kitten GIFs? Okay. I told you about one of mine a few weeks ago, Google's Ngram Viewer. You punch in words and it sifts through millions of digitized books, showing you how often those words have been used over the last 5 centuries. Like any toy, it's more fun when you have people to play with, so I asked you to send us the best discovery you made using the Ngram Viewer. Dozens of you responded, tracking words such as awesome, groovy, and garbage patch, and comparing usage of emigrant and immigrant, freedom and war, ketchup and catsup. A listener in Chicago investigated the writer Vladimir Nabokov, who had once written, Lolita is famous, not I. I am an obscure, doubly obscure novelist with an unpronounceable name. I called up Juan Martinez, who had decided to test Nabokov's claim.
What I ended up doing is we put in Vladimir Nabokov as a phrase and Lolita and see what comes up.
And from your Ngram, over time, it looks like Lolita does keep getting more famous as Vladimir Nabokov, sadly, appears less in English books.
Waned. That's right. However, I'm lucky enough to be friends with a really good mathematician who went back and double-checked my work. And he decided to go ahead and not put in Vladimir Nabokov, but to put in Nabokov, and to actually remove the default smoothing that Engram has, so that instead of having these beautiful flowing charts, you actually have sort of the spikes and the valleys in the chart. And so if you just do a search for Nabokov and Lolita without Vladimir, it turns out that Nabokov wins.
That's interesting, because what it suggests to me, perhaps, is that, in fact, Nabokov is so famous that his name is frequently referred to just the last name, as though, of course, we all know who that is. I don't even need to give his first name.
Absolutely. He's kind of a little brand.
Exactly. Now, you teach literature, yes?
I do. I do, actually. I teach literature and creative writing, but I did a little bit of reading and some big data stuff for my dissertation.
Really?
Not a lot, but a little bit.
Wow. You are the perfect person to have played along with us in this game. Why do you think, I mean, in addition to it being this widely read controversial book when it came out 50 or 60 years ago, why is it so in the popular currency? Just because it's a great name? Nabokov just came up with a great name for this character and wisely made it the title of the book?
I think that may actually have so much to do with it, because it is such a beautiful name. I mean, he does spend the first little section of the novel, Humbert does, talking about what an awesome name his name is. So it kind of ran away from the book itself. And of course, it sort of picked up all sorts of other, you know, very unsavory connotations later on. So the book and the character in it sort of kind of ran off almost and left Nabokov a little bit behind.
Well, I thank you very much. This was terrific. Thanks for playing along.
Oh, well, thank you. I had a great time.
Excellent.
All right. Take care.
Juan Martinez teaches writing and literature at Northwestern University. Thanks to all of you who shared your Engram discoveries so far. You can see some of our picks at studio360.org, and please feel free to add more.
Words without love are just words with no meaning, and the feeling that something has died, I can't hide with only words.
Coming up, party monster Andrew W.K. and indie rocker Tao Nguyen are back to reveal the winner of our Battle of the High School Bands.
I don't know if it's evolution of the species. I think it's proof that humans are getting smarter or better at making music. It's inspiring.
The winner and the world premiere of the cover version by Andrew and Tao. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
I used to have Rock Band back in high school.
I don't even know what it is, but you've got it.
Battle of the High School Band.
Excellent! Yeah!
At the beginning of the summer, we challenged you to share the best music you made while you were a teenager. Songs poured in. Psychedelic pop from the 60s, power pop from the 70s, punk from the 80s, grunge from the 90s, and just about every genre imaginable since the year 2000.
High school.
It's fun
in high school.
And now, at last, it's time to reveal the winning entry. I'm joined by our rock star judges, Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen. Andrew and Tao, welcome back once again to Studio 360.
Oh, my pleasure, and so exciting.
No problem. Thank you for having us.
Well, now that you've had a chance to listen to all of the music that came in from people all over America and, in fact, the world, what did you each think of the submissions and what you heard?
I was so incredibly impressed with all the entries, and I was sad to have to choose a few and then one because I thought that they covered the gamut.
Andrew, what was your reaction to all of this?
Well, I felt the same way as Tao just said, in terms of being very impressed. I don't know if it's just evolution of the species, because a lot of these more recent high school songs really blow away the quality on every level that my friends and I were able to muster up in high school. I think it's proof that humans are getting smarter or better at making music. It's inspiring.
We will get to the grand winner in a minute, but first I want to listen to a couple of the runners-up. Tao, tell us about one of your favorites.
Certainly. It's called Mother Tongue by Cachabacha. I think it made this year or last year, and as Andrew stated, is evidence of evolution. I thought the melodies were really beautiful, and the lyrics. As a listener, I listened to lyrics most closely, more closely than I listen to other things, and so I was very impressed.
And I don't know how they did it there, but I like it over here. I'll roll my eyes sometimes, and you'll be far sometime, but right here, right now, we've never been so clear.
And that's Mother Tongue by a couple of young women in New Jersey called Cachabacha. They attend Rutgers Preparatory School in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Andrew, you also had a favorite among the runners-up. Can we hear about one of yours?
Absolutely. The song that I really, really liked, it was a captivating song called Watch Out. It's like the most humble vocal I have ever heard, that at the same time is never boring or withdrawn. The lyrics are very clever. It's very playful. It has one of the best band names I've ever heard, assuming that no one else ever used it. The band is called Trio. It just doesn't get any better than that. I was just really taken by the unique emotional space that this singer occupies.
In a few years down the road, we're all living the dream. Love lots of records, fans, and limousines. We have a lot of work to do, but it's all fun times. So watch out, Clapton, cause the song rhymes. This is what I'm talking about, music. It's a musical song. This next part's a good part.
Youth.
My God.
That was some of Watch Out by Trio. What did you think of that, Tao? Yeah.
It was one of my favorites as well. And I love that sort of Guns of Brixton meets Kimya Dawson thing happening. And so intelligent and self-referential.
Yeah, exactly. It's a song about itself.
Big fan.
And about them, which is hard to pull off.
And I want to say that the members are currently students at Cleveland High School in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. So now on to the winner among these 300-plus songs. You guys ended up choosing The River, a bit of which we played a few weeks ago on the show, by B, Rita, and Maeve, who went to two different high schools in Nashville just a couple of years ago, Hume Fogg School and Christ Presbyterian Academy. So why The River?
Well, this was a song, when I thought about one that we'd have to choose, I was also just thinking about a song that as many people I could imagine would want to listen to. And there was a very timeless quality that this song had without necessarily being nostalgic. And I was just, again, also very impressed with the quality of their performance and their writing abilities.
in addition, there was a subtlety and a refinement in the musicianship and the arrangement and the vocal deliveries that I really appreciated.
Come to that river, it'll make you whole. The river heals and the river hates. The river steals and the river takes. Come to that river.
We're now going to call one of the members, Bea Troxell, whom we found out wrote that song, and whom I, as soon as I saw her name, Bea Troxell, realized that it's an anagram for Beetle Rocks. But let's call her and let her know she's won, because she doesn't know that yet.
Oh.
Ooh, this is exciting.
Hello?
Hello, Bea?
Yes?
Hi, this is Kurt Anderson from Studio 360.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, I'm good, too, and I want to thank you so much for sending in your song, and I also want to let you know that I've got Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen with me as well.
Really?
How you doing?
Hello, how are you?
Hi.
B, we are pleased to inform you that you're the winner of the contest.
That's so exciting. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. It's really impressive, and I can't speak for Andrew, but it did make me feel a little bit bad about what I did in high school, in the best way. So
it ruined my entire perception of myself in high school hearing this song, in the best way, though.
Thank you. Oh,
yeah, and be sure to tell the other band members, well done.
Yeah, I will. Oh, my goodness.
So, B, back in the day when you were writing this, what inspired it?
It sounds so silly, but I had a crush on the boy I was rock climbing with. But it was like one of those crushes that was like, this can never be. And so I went home, and then it turned into something else altogether. I think it was just about things that you want that aren't good for you.
The promise we made, in addition to the glory of winning Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands, is that Andrew and Tao would cover your song, mm-hmm. which they've done.
They've already done it.
They've already done
it. Yeah, we already did it. I don't know how we pulled it off, but we recorded our very own version of The River.
Yeah, we can't believe it either.
Oh, I'm so excited to hear it.
Well,
yeah, be careful now, because it's pretty intense.
Be careful what you wish for, because here is Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen doing their version, with Tao on lead vocal, guitar and mandolin, and Andrew on drums, bass, organ, and piano of The River.
Okay.
Your vocal performance is better than mine, B. I'm not ashamed to admit that.
Fire, grass and
empty space. Transformation now takes place.
That was B. Rita and Maeve's The River, performed by Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen. What did you think, B.?
It's really cool to hear that song played by different people. It was really neat.
B., are you in school for music, or what are you doing?
I'm in school for environmental studies.
Oh, that's
great. A lot of music on the side. But I don't think I would still love it if I were doing it as a major.
Yeah. I went to school for women's studies and sociology.
I went to school for party studies.
I was waiting that whole time for Andrew to say that.
B, I want to thank you and Rita and Maeve so much for performing this and submitting the river to our contest. And thanks so much for making time for us today.
Yeah, thank you. This is a big honor. Thanks.
Keep playing music, please.
Yeah.
Keep making music, please.
I'll try.
Well done.
So, Tao and Andrew, any closing thoughts on the experience?
Mostly for me, it was just very inspiring. It reminds me once again, in the best way, of how vast and limitless music is. You know, it's infinite, and that's a really good feeling to come away with from any experience, especially a contest.
How about you, Tao?
It was really so impressive and really inspiring to hear music that was made only for the joy of making music. And I think sometimes when we make music for a living, you get weighted down with more peripheral issues that prove to be more burdensome than they're worth. And so it's really nice to hear music that's just made for the joy of it, and it's nice to be reminded and to be taken back there myself.
Well, there you go. I have goosebumps listening to the music and hearing you guys talk about it. And I want to thank you again so much for judging our Studio 360 Battle of the High School Bands. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can listen to the original version of The River by B, Rita, and Maeve at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can also download Andrew and Tao's brand new cover version. If that's not enough, we've also got two volumes of mixtapes we compiled from all the entries. And if you're a completist, go ahead and listen to all 300-plus songs that were submitted. Thank you all so very, very much for sharing them. Rock on, Studio 360 listeners. Rock on. And since your summer just wouldn't be the same without a fresh piece of Studio 360 homework, here's a new challenge. few weeks ago, the Bank of England announced plans to put Jane Austen's face on the £10 note, or, as I think of it, the $16 bill. Switzerland already celebrates its best artists on every piece of money, which got us to thinking. Our American paper money is uniform in the worst way. Same size, same color, same group of white guys from the 18th and 19th centuries. So let's try to shake things up, shall we? We want your help to replace Benjamin and Company with great American artists. The first step, nominate 6 creative masters of any kind, painters, musicians, writers, directors. All we ask is that they be American artists and that they're dead. So, 6 names, 1 each for the $1 bill, the 5, the 10, the 20, 50, and 100. Visit studio360.org to nominate your artists. We're also planning to come up with some fresh designs for those bills in the weeks ahead. James Turrell is one of my favorite living artists, but he makes being a fan kind of tough. Most of his work is in places you can't get to easily, like a remote Japanese island and, most famously, below an extinct volcano in Arizona. His main medium is natural light, and what he does with it is extraordinary and sublime and hard to photograph. But this summer has been a great one for Turrell's fans. LACMA in Los Angeles, Houston's Museum of Fine Arts, and the Guggenheim in New York City are all showing works by Turrell. It's the biggest art event of the summer. His main installation at the Guggenheim is called Atten Rain. Studio 360's Rachel Lewis Criske braved the long line to get in and see it.
Have you ever taken a moment to really think about light? That's what the artist James Turrell is all about. Turrell is a light and space artist. He creates structures that contain light the same way a cup holds water. He makes it almost tangible. This summer, 3 museums across the country are showing Turrell's mind-bending art. At the Guggenheim in New York, he's created an installation called Atten Rain, in reference to Aten, the Egyptian sun god. The piece encourages visitors to think about light and color in new ways. Maybe that's why Atten Rain is so difficult to put into words.
Awesome doesn't even describe it. Awesome is a trite word.
I'm not sure that it would bear description. It seems impossible to sort of maybe bridge the gap, and maybe that's the poetry of the experience, you know? So.
Yeah, it's the subtlety of it that's really hard to capture. We all probably take something different from it, so it's hard to explain.
Nat Trotman is an associate curator at the Guggenheim.
So all of James Turrell's works are very personal. They all address each of us individually through our bodies, through our senses. But many of them also gather people together in a more communal setting. And the piece at the Guggenheim is probably the most large-scale communal atmosphere of perhaps any of his works.
When you walk into the Guggenheim, you expect to see Frank Lloyd Wright's famous central rotunda. But what you find is that Turrell has covered the spiraling walkway with layers of enormous glowing rings. The best way to experience Atten Rain is to actually lie down on the floor and stare up at the ceiling. What you see is a stunning cone of light that saturates the space in vibrant colors.
I'm just amazed by the intimacy of the space in here. It's just, it's a totally different experience than walking into the Guggenheim as you usually do. It doesn't seem like the same space.
It's very natural. You don't really feel that it's striking at the beginning. It kind of comes down upon you in a very subtle way, which is, I think, the best part about it.
And then I think especially to walk into a museum and have everyone laying on the floor, just staring up, it kind of was so communal an experience. And like, you know, I was sitting there turning to someone like, oh my God, did you just see that?
Looking at Atten Rain is kind of like cloud watching. Everyone sees something different. A layered lampshade, the rings of Saturn, a kaleidoscope.
I think it reminds me maybe of the snail shell or maybe Sydney Opera House perhaps, or even sometimes the color cards when I go color matching in the paint shop.
In some ways, especially when it's blue, it reminds me of a really quiet aquarium.
It was kind of like inhaling and exhaling colors.
Terrell and his lighting team programmed the installation to shift through the full color spectrum over the course of an hour. The colors change slowly and subtly, a process that plays tricks on the eye.
First, I was just there looking at the color. And I was like, wait, is that color changing?
We talked a lot about how different colors were making us feel. So, like, some of the lighter colors, you felt like you were going towards the ceiling. There was one point where it felt like we were very claustrophobic because it was a darker gray color and everything was kind of closing in.
What struck me about his work, knowing nothing about him before, was that it's almost like he's painting with light, that, you know, he's taken colors and just shown them to me in a different way that I wouldn't have expected or have seen anyone do before.
I'm there trying to figure out what I think about the light and how it's affecting me. So it's much more, in a very narcissistic way, about me. And I'm not trying to figure out what he's doing. I'm trying to figure out what I'm thinking.
When you step out, you do have sort of a weird thing going on with your eyes, sort of a lingering after effect.
We both held on to each other to stand up for a second. It was like, oh, wow, standing up, redo, reset.
It's hard to walk away from Mountain Rain. And even hours later, something about the piece stays with you. A sense of contemplation, and maybe a new perspective on light. Again, Nat Trotman.
What I hope people will experience in the piece is some sense of calm and a moment that they can meditate and reflect individually, but at the same time, sort of share this experience with the other people in the room, and that they'll have this common experience that they will share forevermore.
Our story was produced by Rachel Lewis Criskey, Mark Sheely, and Ellen Mayer. The James Terrell shows in New York and Houston are up until late September. The one in Los Angeles runs through next April. You can see a slideshow of some of James Terrell's work at studio360.org. Still ahead this hour, Tony Hale, who's all over TV these days. But before he was on Easy Street as an actor, he was on just a street.
My first theater show was Shakespeare in the Parking Lot, where we did Taming of the Shrew in a parking lot in the East Village. All I ever wanted was a sitcom.
Tony Hale now stars in Arrested Development and Veep. I'll talk to him next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
American icons aren't just popular. They've got power over us.
It kind of shows you the degree to which art and design can really control and manipulate people. In the world of Disney, the artist is God.
From Disneyland to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Studio 360's American icons help explain what it means to be American. I'm Kurt Anderson. Stay tuned for a brand new series of American icons coming this fall. When you wish
upon... I think we found a part of the pterodactyl under Fashion Island.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Tony Hale is magnificent at playing a certain kind of adorable, ridiculous freak. First, on the sharp, super funny comedy series Arrested Development, as the man-child Buster Bluth, this totally codependent, helpless mama's boy with a prosthetic hook.
Buster!
It's a bird!
I know it's a bird! I'm on the phone!
It walks on my pillow!
And now he's about to start the third season of HBO's Veep. His character there, Gary Walsh, is the totally codependent, hopeless, devoted aide to Julia Louis-Dreyfus's vice president.
Remember, take care of Selena, okay? VP stands for very precious.
Wait, I think I see a pattern here. Tony Hale, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. And you do see a pattern. You're absolutely correct.
And given the pattern-ness, was there any reluctance to take the role on Veep?
No, because, I mean, I was a huge fan of Armando Iannucci, who created Veep, and then obviously Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who plays the vice president. And I kind of see Gary, the character on Veep, as kind of a high-functioning Buster. Buster right. pretty much can't probably leave his room.
Yes.
He's probably just rocking in a corner. Whereas Gary, you know, he can handle society. And he actually steps up to the plate to defend his woman, whereas Buster does not defend his mother at all.
That's true. Now, Arrested Development was only on the air for 3 seasons and canceled in 2006. And ever since, its resurrection in some form or another was rumored. Did you finally make peace with the fact that, that's never going to happen, I'll move on?
Totally. I mean, when it finished in 2006, you kind of, I think with any kind of job you have, you kind of go through a mourning process when it's done and you kind of, you know, lay it to bed. And then the opportunity that, you know, when it just came to do it again, it was very, very surreal. And actually, I mean, honestly, I was cautious kind of doing it again because there was so much expectation put
yeah.
on it. And Buster is such an extreme character. But when I got on set, the first day I was on set, the whole cast was there. And when I heard everybody's character talking, and specifically Jessica Walter, who plays my mother on the show, her degrading, you know, patronizing ways in her voice, it just clicked right back in. It was just like riding a bike again. It was very Pavlovian and terrifying at the same time.
You were trying to push me out of the nest. You were right.
Really?
Yes. I've grown. And I'm in love.
Hamster or turtle?
Don't bother. Hamsters are gross. It's a female. Human. Female. Human. Whole thing. So, your parental responsibilities are complete.
What?
I no longer need you.
Well, you don't have to go that far.
I'm not a mother boy anymore. I'm a mother man.
And you slipped right in, even though it's 7 years later, as though time had not passed?
Yeah, and I didn't think, I thought it would take a little more work, but once I heard her voice, man, it was just, it just clicked right back in.
On Arrested Development, as they finally said, okay, we're going to do this new season, did you then go back and rewatch the first three? Or did you just go with it and wait to be Pavlovianly commanded by the actress playing her mother?
I did. I kind of watched, because what's funny is I was watching the first season of Arrested and I kind of skipped into episodes and up to the third. And Buster just got crazier and crazier. And so doing the fourth season, you know, I kind of wanted to, you know, just kind of ground him more and just because the circumstances were so nuts and just to kind of how would a person react to those circumstances? Because Buster's had some pretty crazy circumstances, like his hand was bitten off by a seal. He's, you know, dating Liza Minnelli. You know, he goes to mother boy conventions with his mother. You know, it's some pretty nutty circumstances. So you could just kind of see how a person would just react to that.
If Arrested were to go on forever and ever, would Buster ever grow up or would he just have to wait for her to die?
I hope not. I hope he never grows up. You really see kind of the depth of his depravity when there's some scenes where he begins to make a doll of his mother, a dummy, because she's not there. And you think, well, my God, it must be like months that he's been away from her. It's been 2 days, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, he really cannot stand 5 minutes outside away from her.
Beyond the mama's boy part of him, one thing I love about the character is that he seems to me kind of a poster boy, emblematic of what I think is this real and large-scale shift of the last couple of generations, which is adults who never managed to grow up. Is there some realness in him that you have drawn on from your life?
From my life.
Not from your life, but from the people you see. The people like him, not you.
Yeah. It's like, oh, good God, this is turning into therapy. Well, yeah, I mean, I think you do find situations where the parents, I mean, obviously Buster and Lucille are extreme cases, but where the kids are so smothered and they're so kind of helicopter parenting their whole life and they just kind of live in this constant state of fear because their parents are giving them this fear of what's out there.
And now that you are a parent of a kid, have you taken that in that idea of non-helicopter parenting to heart?
Man, I mean, it's so easy to say, but it is hard to not be a helicopter parent. When I see someone, you know, in the past, if I've seen a child be mean to my daughter, it's just this rage that comes over you and you wanting to take over and, you know, stand up for her. And of course you do at times, but it's like they've got to walk through that. And that is tough.
Yes.
I mean, that is really, really, really tough. And you also, I mean, they're so innocent and so sweet. And the minute you see something harsh happen to them, you're just like, no, they're being poisoned, but like they have to walk through that.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of paying attention to the people you're responsible for, on Veep, you play the vice president's personal aide, her body man, attending to every possible need and whim. Mm-hmm. Veep has a level of realism, not documentary realism, but it seems like those characters are very realistically ambitious and egomaniacal and awful.
Yeah, I love that, especially with politics, you do kind of hear these perfect sound bites. You kind of see people posturing for power. But the fact is they're human beings who are just like pressure cookers for massive decisions of our nation. And they have to freak out behind the scenes. They have to get insecure. They have to lose their minds. They have to vent. And I love that Veep kind of takes you behind the scenes and shows you that, shows the humanity. I mean, obviously, it's a satire, but it really kind of brings the humanity back to a little bit.
I want to play a clip from Veep so people know what we mean.
Are we early?
Yeah, I want to get there early. I want the people who are on time to think that they're late.
Oh, mind games. Love it.
Yeah.
I appreciate the reference to my potential suicide earlier. I'm not a joke.
No, you're the guy with the big bag of lip balm, Gary. You're f***ing Kissinger. Gosh.
Every single thing you say to me is emasculating. Do you realize that?
Yes.
That is Tony Hale from Veep.
Yeah. He's trying so hard to convince people, like, do you see what you're saying? And they're like, yeah, we see it. It's clear.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
okay, exactly. Well, as long as you got it.
You were not a kid when you got your breakthrough part in Arrested Development. You were 32. You'd been an actor mm-hmm. for a decade or more. Had you gotten to the point where you worried, like, is this show business thing going to work out?
You know, it was one of those things where I was in New York for 8 years doing commercials. I did mainly commercials in New York for a long time and then theater. My first theater show was Shakespeare in the Parking Lot, where we did Taming of the Shrew in a parking lot in the East Village.
I can imagine being 32 and having had the career you've had and thinking like, geez, maybe my parents were right. Maybe I should have a fallback career.
Oh, yeah. But I think when you're in the business, I would say every single day you think that.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, I mean, should I be doing this? I mean, I knew I wanted to do it and just kind of keep walking with it because I enjoyed it. I was getting commercial work and then just kind of getting more accustomed to kind of like it's job to job. It's gig to gig.
As I was reading about you, I saw that you went to college in Alabama at this Christian college, Baptist college, mm-hmm. and then to graduate school in Virginia at a Christian institution. Is traditional Christianity a big part of your life?
It is. I mean, it definitely is. It's there are people that I would like to take the microphone away from because it gives a bad rep for the other Christians. But I will say in my business, and I'm talking about uncertainty, to know that or to believe that someone has my back, really.
Right.
But I mean, I will say also with my faith, it's taught me a ton of lessons, actually. And one, I remember when I got, when I booked Arrested Development, I remember going, because I mean, all I ever wanted was a sitcom, and that's all I ever wanted. And I remember when I booked it, I remember this place of going like, oh, this doesn't satisfy the way I thought it was going to satisfy. And I was really frustrated and slightly depressed. And it was just that kind of lesson, that life lesson. This really isn't just about faith, but it was just kind of if you're not – and I feel like if you're not practicing contentment where you're at, you're not going to be content when you get what you want.
Yep.
And my whole time in New York, I just was constantly looking to that sitcom. And then it really – I wasn't being present. And it's – ever since then, it's just been this – which I think is spiritual, just like owning where you're at and making the most of where you're at and waking yourself up each day to where you're at. Because it makes everything else just well, you're living it rather than so far into the future. I literally just turned into Oprah.
That's all right. Well, I invited you to. And the fact that you that both Arrested Development and Veep, neither of them are in any way pious or reverent shows, and here you are a Christian. Does either of those things make it awkward for you in godless Hollywood?
No, not at all. Because it's life, man. I mean, I think Christians that are, or really anybody for that matter, who are trying to put up a perfect image or how it's supposed to be, they're clearly not, acknowledging their own stuff and that everybody's got stuff. With both Arrested and Veep, I love that it shows just kind of how twisted people can be. But then you also see that I think everybody acknowledges, wow, that's pretty twisted. Let's maybe try to go the opposite direction or, not follow this example and just use the comedy that way.
Tony Hale, it has been a pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was fun.
Good.
Well, I feel just like a child.
You can see all four seasons of Arrested Development on Netflix, and season three of Veep starts airing on HBO next spring.
Well, I feel just like a child. From my womb to my tomb, I guess I'll always be a child. Well, some people try and treat me like a man.
And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget about our new challenge. We want to know which American artists, writers, filmmakers, dancers, painters, whatever you'd like to see on our money, from the 1 up to the 100. Tell us at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramosferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Jamie York,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tieten.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
There's the camera, and this one says, "Be a beautiful girl." Do you want to be a beautiful girl?
I do. I've always wanted to be a beautiful girl.
Okay.
We burrow deep into contemporary Japan.
I'm excited.
A Japanese makeover for me. Next time in
Studio 360 with Kato Anderson
from PRI and WNYC.